street full of people and this is going to be brutal. I was the first one.
Yeah. And so Pete did a gig out of a window. That's what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Which is not the traditional. I don't know if any of you have ever done stand-up comedy, but that is not the traditional way to do stand-up comedy.
No, out of a window. But I did it.
Yeah. Kind of like a comedy ice cream man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I didn't jump. So there you go.
That's what happens.
That's how you do it. So how'd the gig go? It's like, well, I didn't end up on the pavement.
That would be, what an incredible way to go out as a stand-up comedian. Just like, that I bombed and now I'm going to kill myself in front of these people. I'm going to change the course of their lives forever. I'm going to bond all of these people in a twisted way as they're splattered with my entrails.
Yeah.
It's probably not a high enough window for entrail splatter, I would imagine.
It's actually the darkest version of the, you know, the, is it the Velvet Underground? Or is it like everybody who saw them went on and started their own band?
Everybody who
saw that went on and killed themselves.
I thought you were going to say went on and became a stand-up comedian, which is pretty dark.
No, this is darker.
guy doing stand-up comedy on the way down from the World Trade Center.
Yeah.
That would have been good. Getting one good bit off when you're sort of in earshot of the ground.
Yeah, one person hears it on the way down. So that was funny.
That was pretty funny.
That was all right, actually.
Shame we lost that guy.
Yeah, cheered me up on the way out.
He was a real talent.
Have you ever done comedy out of a window?
No, I'm trying to think what is the weirdest place I've done comedy. Between two escalators? That was pretty bad.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Were you leaning, like, now?
It was some sort of corporate event for a shopping center in Kazan in central Russia. I used to have this agent in Russia, Maxim, who was like, God bless him, a fucking idiot.
Yeah.
And I think he used to be like a carpet salesman or something. And he sort of brought that energy to being a comedy agent where he was very good at bringing work in.
Yeah.
But he was very undiscerning as to what the work was. He would only look at the numbers.
Yeah.
And so he'd be like, oh, Milo, you should do this show in Kazan. It's 1,000 euros. And I'm like, okay, fine. And then he'd be like, I would ask some questions about the setup. And he's like, yeah, it's fine. I've sorted it all. But actually, he hadn't sorted anything. He was like, 1,000 euros. That's 200 euros for me. And then he doesn't have to deal with whatever fucked up shit is there when I get there. Yeah. And so I did a lot of these gigs with like a corporate where you just turn up and you're like, what is going on? And yeah, there, this one was like in the atrium of the shopping center, like between the two main escalators.
Yeah.
And it was just anyone who's wandering through the shopping center can like stop and listen to you. Insane.
Great.
So there were a bunch of like teenage girls who'd like come to see me and this other comedian, Andre, who they'd seen on the TV. And then it was just like people with kids just like hanging out.
Yeah.
And then like the guy, the promoter was like, oh, by the way, you've got to like do all clean material because there's like 4-year-olds there. And I was like, yeah, I can't actually do that because A, you didn't warn me. And if you had warned me, I would have refused the gig.
Yeah.
And I'm like, why are there 4-year-olds there? And he's like, well, it's a shopping center. And I'm just like, why have you booked stand-up comedy for a shopping center in the middle of the, like, none of this makes sense.
Yeah.
It was a pretty horrendous gig. There was just like toddlers just like playing at the front of the crowd. Just like, to be fair, completely unaware that there was stand-up comedy going on. That was,
yeah.
There's a certain age of child below which you can actually say anything.
Yeah.
Because they're not going to get it anyway.
Have you done gigs with like for one of those baby gig where there's like, you can bring a baby, it's for adults, the comedy, but it's full of babies. You don't want those gigs?
I haven't.
I've done those gigs.
Okay. how is that?
It's an interesting experience in dealing with the fact that you're just hearing babies cry the entire time you're talking about topics that babies shouldn't be listening to. whatever it is that you can swear, and like, because they're babies, they're not going to understand.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You're talking about your hairline and they're just weeping.
They're like, oh, no, not this. We don't want this future. but that's so funny.
Babies are all bald. They can talk.
Not all of them. This is the thing I'm finding out going to do these baby gigs. Is that some of these babies have lush heads of hair. And it's very upsetting.
Look at this fella right here. He's a real slaphead. Look at him.
This is my opener.
Yeah.
Is that some of them aren't as bald as I am?
Yeah.
Literally how I open those shirts.
Chap of about 2 weeks.
He's all right. Can we get some of this?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I've never done that. And some people do that comedy for kids too, where they're like,
that's crazy.
Yeah, that's scary.
Yeah.
That's like, people are like, oh, when it's scary when there's a stag doing. No, doing a room of 10-year-olds is the scariest thing I can think of.
Have you performed to kids before?
Never.
I did one which was for a children's hospital. It was a small group of kids. And it was a group of comics.
Right.
And at one point, one of my friends was doing his set. He told a story and he goes, you guys want to hear another story? And they were like, no.
That is
and
brutal.
And they're sick kids, you know?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
They're
yeah.
like, we don't have a lot of
time. They've not got time, yeah, for another story. They're like, I can't waste.
You cannot hear more of this.
This is a significant percentage of the rest of my life here. This I can't be dealing
with
this.
Wrap this up. They were giving everybody the light. They were great, like, but yeah, it was very much
that's
like,
you giving them a light. That would be good. Yeah, yeah. It's like a gong show.
I think I did one joke, and one of the kids said, did you think that'd be funny? Which is like, yeah, I did actually.
Yeah, presumably, yeah.
I thought it would be and you didn't, so that's fine. But thank you.
Thanks for your advice. Thanks for your input.
Thanks for the input.
Yeah, the worst thing would obviously be the kid dying in the middle of the sand.
Sorry. Just like,
I really shuffled him off.
Yeah, tough.
Yeah. Although that does imply he was enjoying it. I feel as though, you know, laughter more likely to take you out than not laughing.
I mean, maybe unless you're like, I'm done. Mm. You just give up. Like, he's been fighting for so long, but this was too much. He couldn't fight any longer. This was too far.
Yeah, yeah. We do have a running joke in our family that a certain member of our extended family who my dad didn't get on with very well actually finished him off because we were like loudly talking about the fact that they were going to be there in a couple of minutes. And then my dad was just like, no, just like, just out. But we're not here to talk about that. No. We're here to talk about I'm Alan Partridge, season one, episode two. The name of which I have now forgotten.
Yeah. Is there a particular naming convention? I haven't looked ahead to pick up on it, similar to how the Friends episodes are all the one with the, you know, like the one with the baby.
Yeah. So this one is they're all something with the word Alan in it. Oh, and it's some kind of play on words that doesn't work. So this one, for example, season one, episode two is Alan Attraction.
Yep.
Yeah. Classic stuff.
Great stuff.
You cannot go wrong.
That is a gag.
Exactly. Coming up, we've got Watership Alan.
Yep.
Basic Alan.
Yep.
To Kill a Mocking Alan. And Towering Alan.
Yep.
That's just season one. The Towering Alan. Alan Attraction, season one, episode two, was released on the 10th of November, 1997. Let's have a look. November 10th, 1997. Jackie, An American Life opens at Belasco Theater, NYC. I love these On These Day websites because they always include like deeply irrelevant American news.
Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
It's so niche.
Yeah.
And almost no international news of any kind. Artist Peter Max pleads guilty to tax fraud and time served.
Damn.
Psychedelic artist. Tommy Tedesco, American jazz guitarist, dies.
R.I.P.
William Allen, American actor from Citizen Kane, dies at 81. Okay, here we go. Number one song. Still Candle in the Wind in America. Still Barbie Girl in the UK. There you go.
I feel like this is going to be this whole run.
Duking it out. Yeah.
These six episodes, I feel like it's going to be those two.
Yeah.
I feel like both of those, they were both at the top for a while.
Yeah.
Two great tracks.
Two great tracks. Two great tracks. And both in honor of Princess Diana, actually. That's what no one knows.
That's the little known part about it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Jumps in a car. Want to go for a ride? R.I.P., you know.
I think it really shows that is the high watermark of British cultural influence, that the Americans' number one is still a song about how Princess Diana is dead. Meanwhile, we in the UK have actually moved on to Barbie Girl by Aqua.
Yeah.
And now I think it's the reverse, unfortunately. They've all got us watching the NFL or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Embarrassing.
It is
stuff.
Interesting that the UK moved on earlier. We're like, it's time to laugh.
Yeah.
We've moved on. We've grown.
It is a long time after her death at that point.
What? When did she die?
It's like August.
Right.
Yeah. I remember because I was on holiday and I was like 4 years old, obviously, but I was on holiday with my parents in Devon. I remember watching it on like a tiny hotel room television.
Yeah, right. The funeral. Yeah.
Not even the funeral, just the
news of it. Yeah.
Like the wreckage and from that age, you have such like vague like snapshot memories, and that's why I can remember just like sitting on my parents' bed in this like hotel, whatever it was, a holiday rental or something, and watching this like 12-inch television.
Well we visited the UK in October of that year, and I remember we visited the palace, and the palace was still like obviously flowers everywhere,
rotting flowers,
being replenished out the front of it. So that's October, and if this happens in August,
people are already starting to leave Barbie Girl merchandise. It's become very confused.
People are getting very excited by this new Aqua band that suddenly hit the scene.
She was the people's Barbie, that's what they said. There was a great, I saw a great TikTok this week. This is always good. So it's sort of semi-related. And it was like one of these, TikTok is always serving me up just like insane, like subcultures of like, and then like one is like, this woman who clears out people's houses after they die. And I'm just like, A, why is this a thing that exists? B, yeah. Why do they have a TikTok?
Yeah.
But okay, I'll watch it.
Yeah.
And it was this insane thing where she's going through and she's like, see, this is what happens after you die. All this stuff might have meant something to you. Doesn't mean anything to your relatives, does it? They're getting rid of it all. She's going through and then she's going, you see, what a rich life this woman had. Look how beautiful she was when she was younger. And then she just pans to a picture of what is clearly Princess Diana on the wall.
Great.
Great stuff.
I mean, that's good.
Good historical knowledge. This was also a British woman in the UK. This wasn't like, you know, this isn't forgivable, knowing who Princess Diana is.
This is one of those, look at these dumb Americans things.
Look
at this dumb English person.
Yeah, this is our own homegrown idiocy.
Great.
And I will have it recognized as such.
Yeah.
We didn't need to outsource anything here.
No.
But yeah, so the episode, Attraction. What did you make of this one?
What were my thoughts on this one? I wrote down every time. Okay. I didn't understand a reference.
Okay, great. All right. Yeah. We'll go through it like that.
I'm like, I don't understand. I'm like, I don't know what this is referring. Like, I don't, mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, I don't get this reference, but I thought it was exciting to see Marsha from Spaced appear as,
oh, who's Marsha from Spaced?
So she plays the woman he goes on a date with.
Jill, the love interest.
Yeah. So she's in Spaced. I remember the actress's name, but
this is funny that Spaced is such a British thing and you've seen it and I haven't.
Oh really? You've never seen Spaced? Let's watch Spaced.
Yeah, that's next.
That's the next season.
Yeah.
Oh really? You've never seen Spaced? Oh my God.
I've never seen it. I know that it's Simon Pegg and Nick Frost, but I think I've seen clips of it actually, but yeah.
And Jessica Stevenson. I mean, I loved it. That when it came out, it was on.
Was it big in Australia?
No, it was on really late in Australia and I just would tape it. Saw an ad for it, being like, that looks really funny. Taped it, and me and my brother would just watch it over and over. Loved it.
Amazing.
This completely missed. Didn't see this at all.
Yeah, it is such a hard thing to explore. Even just watching it now, it's just like so, I don't know, it's just so like mired in like the vibes of this country.
Yeah.
And I think actually if you've lived in this country for even a week, you immediately understand it. But if you haven't done that, it's like quite hard to like, yeah.
It is interesting, having met dudes, even like dudes who do comedy who also work in radio, who have the same vibe.
who
are doing like regional radio sort of stuff. I'm like, yeah. Mm. Oh, okay. I get it.
It's also strange watching it now because when I first watched this, I was like a teenager, I guess. That's kind of when I got into it. So long after it came out. But watching it now, I'm like, it's so weird how Steve Coogan is supposed to be old. Because he's like 32 in the first season and like he's playing this character who's like in his like mid to late 40s and they've just kind of like put some grey in his hair and stuff. Yeah. But like there's like bits where like the lap dancing scene where you just like that's just like the body of a young man.
Yeah.
It's very like feels weird. But I guess I was like young enough that I was like, yeah, that guy's old.
yeah, this is an old man.
Yeah.
And half the bit being like, this is a young man playing an old man, that's a bit almost.
Mm.
Yeah, I guess my thoughts on it is I have questions about, does he have an ex-wife?
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Has he had sex before?
Supposedly.
Supposedly. Okay. These are my questions that I'm coming away with.
Yeah. This is sort of, Alan Partridge's like prior relationships are sort of a mysterious.
Yes.
Carol, the ex-wife, comes up a lot. You never see her.
Great.
There's bits where she'll be like on the phone or something. I don't think you even hear her voice.
Yep.
But she is like alluded to. She's kind of like dark matter. Like there's things that you can sort of infer things about her from other things that you do see. But there's no she's never directly seen or heard.
Yep.
Obviously we get this kind of like ongoing dynamic of the fact that Lynn is clearly in love with Alan Partridge.
Yeah.
But he doesn't have eyes for Lynn. You know, he's not interested in Lynn.
No.
This is his great, you know, the duality of Alan. So then I think one of the cruxes of this episode is that he's using a big plate to scam the hotel buffet.
Yeah.
Classic dad stuff.
It's the gag with the hotel buffet that, it's dumb to ask the question, but like, you just take back the small plate, right? What? You can just get more food on the small.
You can go back. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But
right.
he is like, he's well, I think play. He actually, because again, I think this goes back to the thing about Alan Partridge, which is that like, he's always right, but in an insane way where like yeah. he's worked out that they give you the small plate to like rate limit you
yeah.
at the hotel buffet. And that's what annoys him. He's like, I want to go and like pile up a monstrous amount of food in one go. Yeah. But like, and also like, not because he's like a big eater. He's just, it's purely principle. It's yeah. Like, he's not a fat man. He's not like a big gourmand or anything. Yeah, and so he's like, he immediately, I see what you're doing here. You're yeah. trying to like, you know, push, like nudge me in a direction with this 7-inch plate, and I'm not doing it.
I clean it here, so save time by cleaning it at the table.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, powerful type of guy.
Yeah.
And so we get sort of an opening interaction with him and the hotel staff again.
Mm.
I love, and again, I hadn't really noticed this particularly watching it years ago, the interactions between him and Sally Phillips, where I'm starting to think that Sally Phillips is actually just corpsing. At first, I thought it was like a deliberate, like the character is supposed to be laughing. But now what I'm seeing it for is a dynamic where like he's just deliberately trying to make her laugh.
Yeah.
And that's very cute.
Yeah, she's a Sophie. That's Sophie? That
yeah,
character?
Yeah.
Sophie is such a great character, openly mocking him to his face.
Yeah.
And like having been that person in an office is like truly, is like, I see you, Sophie. I see you, I've been you. This is great. Like,
yeah, yeah.
I think probably my favorite character on the show.
Yeah, yeah. She's
the one
funny.
Who is very openly being like, we all can say this man is ridiculous.
Yeah, 100%.
And he's just like, okay.
Yeah, because he's got everyone chocolate oranges.
Yeah.
He's done some deal with this shop called Rawlinson's where he's got all of their like shop damaged chocolate oranges
yeah.
and he's given them out to people. And he's like, they're all, you know, that there may be some superficial damage to the box. And then there's one point where he's discussing Sophie's one. She's like, oh, there was some damage. And he's like, they're all damaged.
I did the, I was just very glad I knew what a chocolate orange was. I was very
yeah.
familiar. So I was like, great. Mm-hmm. If I was American, I'd be lost.
Yeah. I presume the chocolate oranges made it to Australia. That feels
of course.
Like
we got them. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We got them big time. The Dawn French ads. Yeah, yeah, we got them.
Oh, okay. Big yeah, time. Yeah, yeah. But you wouldn't, they wouldn't congeal into a hard chocolate cricket ball as Alan Partridge threatens because they'd be made out of that different
Australian
type chocolate.
Yeah, that doesn't melt as quick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is strange, though.
We've done that.
I don't know why, because as far as I know, having been to many countries that are kind of like similarly hot to Australia, you seem to be the only country that does this. And so that's why I've kind of been like, oh, isn't she? Like, if you go and buy chocolate in California, I mean, aside from the fact that American chocolate sucks, but
yes.
like, if you buy the foreign chocolate, it's like the same.
Yeah.
And so I don't know. This is off topic, but I've been fascinated at what machinations took place in the Australian government to provoke this.
I mean, what a great question.
Yeah. Like, one day Bob Hawke was
it
just like eating
they
a
don't
melting
do it in the
twirl.
States, then.
Yeah.
But does it melt? They just leave it.
I don't think so, because I mean, like, shops are air conditioned, and like, you wouldn't leave it out in the sun. It feels as though you're preparing chocolate for something it wasn't designed to withstand, like
yes.
just like being out on like a hot patio table for 2 hours. It's like, well, yeah, I mean, you can't do that. You can't do it with chicken breast either. But we've not changed the composition of that.
I bought a chocolate recently.
Okay,
if you can believe this.
Right. Yeah.
I bought a chocolate
this guy's
in this country,
out.
In the United Kingdom, and I put it in my pocket of my hoodie.
Mm-hmm.
Just to take it home and eat it later.
Yeah.
Melted by the, like, it had melted just on that journey.
In a hoodie pocket, too. That's
yeah.
Kind of,
and I'm like, is this too
pocket.
Close to my, I'm like, is this too close? What's,
you're what? Radiating heat.
Yeah.
You've got a very warm stomach.
I was just like back where I came from.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
This would not have been. And I'm not even, I'm, so this yeah. is what I'm wondering.
The chocolate wouldn't have been that good, but it wouldn't have melted.
It would not have melted.
That's never happened to me.
Yeah. I am
holding it in your hand too long. Yeah, I've had that.
Yeah. But I was just, I'm like,
hoodie pocket. That seems.
Put it in my pocket.
Trouser pocket, maybe I wouldn't risk. That feels like you're asking, it's too tight.
Yeah.
But hoodie pocket, yeah.
And it wasn't even that long. I'm like, this isn't that long of a journey before I partake.
What brand of chocolate was this? What was the.
What was it? I think it was a Yorkie.
Oh, yeah. And you see, now that I would describe as a chocolate with quite a high tolerance for, you know, it's solid.
So.
You know, something like a Twirl, I'm like, yeah, it's a high risk. It's a high risk chocolate bar, but a Yorkie.
Well, it started like it was getting, soft and it was melting.
Maybe that's why they say it's not for girls, because it's
for
so
girls.
Warm. their bodies are just so
temperatures are all over the
place. Yeah, it just melts like putty in a woman's touch. Yeah, you know, you need a sort of the cold touch of a man for a Yorkie. It wasn't even sexist messaging. It was just advice.
It's useless.
By all means, have a go. But you know,
yeah.
They used to do Yorkies in they may still do, but they used to specifically do Yorkies in British Army ration kits.
Oh, really?
That said, it's not for civvies on it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if they're still allowed to do that. They don't do the "it's not for girls" thing anymore.
Yeah.
Although apparently it was one of the most successful marketing gambits of all time.
Really?
Yeah, because apparently they sold loads to women who were just like annoyed by it in a sort of. But then also, it's the sort of thing you look back on it now and you're like, that's insane.
I mean, that's a crazy campaign for a chocolate that is pretty normal. Like, this is like a kind of a regular chocolate.
It's chunky.
Yeah, it's just a chunky chocolate bar. It's not like masculine.
Yeah.
The font's rather masculine. but it's not like, even it being called Yorkie isn't like, look out, fellas.
My gender-affirming chocolate.
Yeah.
Not a girly chocolate like a galaxy.
No, I guess that's what you're like. Yeah. How do we separate ourselves out? It's like, well, we don't have any swirls in our lettuce.
Yeah. Well, because galaxy chocolate ads were always like, it's like a woman eating it in the bath and making like the sort of like the herbal essences orgasm noise.
Yeah.
And which I also always found strange. Like, it's just chocolate.
Yeah, it's like the Diet Coke and some chocolate, and then like a Magnum ice cream.
Yeah.
Very feminine.
I learned something crazy about Diet Coke the other day. Actually.
What's this?
Because for years I prefer Coke Zero to Diet Coke.
I can't stand a zero sugar drink. Gives me headaches.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Headaches.
Yeah.
Oh, how funny.
I need full sugs.
Need full sugs. Yeah. That caffeine makes you demand sugar.
Yeah.
But yeah. So I can't handle the full sugar Coke anymore. Just like, I feel like I'm gonna die if I drink it. So like, but the Diet Coke, I don't like the taste that much. Coke Zero, I find tastes kind of like Coke. So I'm not a big soda guy anyway. But if I'm drinking a Coke, Coke Zero. And for years I've had to put up with people saying like, oh, you know, that's a marketing ploy, actually. It doesn't taste any different. They just, men wouldn't buy Diet Coke because they thought it was gay. So, you know, they made Coke Zero for men like you whose masculinity couldn't handle Diet Coke. And I'm like, that's not true. I would happily drink Diet Coke if I preferred the taste. I'm not like, whoa, I'm gay for drinking this. Like, what? Like, what? Where did that come from? And then I found out this isn't true. The recipes are different.
Yeah.
But what's crazy is that actually, in some ways, the opposite is true, which is that actually they changed the flavor of Diet Coke. Basically, when they first developed Diet Coke in testing, it tasted kind of like Coke Zero does now. And they wanted to market it mostly to women as like a diet drink. But what they discovered was people that they tested it on didn't think it tasted bad enough, and they wouldn't believe that it didn't have sugar in it. And so they had to make it taste a bit like bitter and metallic to get people to believe that it was actually a diet soda. Otherwise, people would just, And so Diet Coke actually deliberately tastes worse than Coke Zero to make you believe that it's diet, even though both have no sugar.
Incredible.
There you go.
That's great.
That's an interesting fact. If you're not laughing, you are learning on this
podcast. And I mean, what an appropriate episode to get distracted initially with chocolate bar talk. It's all throughout the episode.
Yeah.
You got the lion bar pops up later on, and there's a whole run of shout outs to various chocolate bars.
Oh yeah, you do get a lion bar. Yeah, we also in this episode we get introduced to the guy who works at the hotel, the young guy whose name I forget. Which is embarrassing given how many times I've watched this show and I could not tell you that guy's name. There's like a young, cool guy who works at the hotel.
So he returns?
He's sort of throughout the season. I was surprised he wasn't in the first episode. It's kind of like, you know, when you've like just watched something many times over many years, you kind of like, you invent versions of it in your head. Yeah. And it never occurred to me that guy wasn't in the first episode. He's such a like fixture throughout.
Yeah, right. Okay.
But yes, he's like the young hip guy. Him and Sophie are kind of like having this will they, won't they type thing. I believe I elbowed my girlfriend at this point and I was like, this is the man you would fancy if you worked at the hotel. And she was like, yes, that's correct.
I mean, there's not a lot of options at the hotel.
Yeah, that is very true. Yeah, it's him or Michael the Geordie.
Yeah.
But it was laser targeted. Yeah, that was... And so Alan doesn't like this man because he's too casual, he's too cool.
Yeah.
Alan's insecurities.
Now that he's saying good morning with his back to him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a funny thing where she was like, oh, is that a problem? And he was like, no, I've just never seen it done before. Pretty good.
Yeah.
And then Lin turns up and she informs him that, you know, he's going to have to sack all the staff at Pear Tree Productions, his production company. Or he could keep two if he's willing to downsize to a Rover Metro.
Right.
And he's like, I'm not driving this. I didn't understand.
The Mini Metro.
Oh, okay. Right. So there used to be a car make in the UK called Austin.
Yep.
This is like a proper, like, yeah, see, it's the 1940s car make. And,
yes.
They were basically in decline. And in the 70s, I want to say, or the 80s, they started making this car called the Austin Mini Metro or something like that. In a kind of last ditch attempt to sell some cars. And it was like a boxy, like, hatchback type thing. And then they got bought out. I don't know whether Mini were also somehow involved. I don't know. Anyway, eventually this all got bought out by Rover, which is another now defunct British car company.
Right. Okay.
And so you had the Rover Metro.
Yeah.
There's an interesting thing in Alan Partridge that I've never quite understood, which is that he regards the Rover as like a fancy car.
Yeah.
Because it's like a British car. And I think back in the day, if you were buying a Rover in the 60s, it was quite a status vehicle. But like, me remembering this as a kid who grew up in the 90s, like, I think they stopped selling Rovers in like the mid 2000s. So I remember people buying Rovers, driving Rovers. They were always kind of like a lame car that someone's granddad would have. Like,
yeah,
I've never really thought of it as like, it's not like having like a BMW or a Mercedes or a Jaguar or like a, I don't know, it was never
cool.
And so I always found it strange that like to Alan Partridge, it's like such a status car, but that's definitely what he thinks.
Yeah.
And so basically he's saying that's not a proper Rover. That's like a rebadged Austin or Mini Metro. He's like, I'm not driving that.
Yeah.
And actually my sister had one of these.
A Mini Metro?
Yeah. The Rover one. And it was an absolute piece of shit. I cannot, this thing, I think it had only a radio. I think it didn't even have a tape deck. And yeah, it was a pretty appalling movie.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay, I see.
Because, when my sister... Actually, yeah, it would have been in about 1997, so around the same time. My sister's quite a bit older than me. And I remember, like, yeah, she had this boyfriend at the time who was, like, a huge unit. He was, like, 6'2", but he was probably about, like, 16 stone or something.
Yeah.
And he used to... When he got in and out of the car, like, the car would visibly move on its suspension. Like, that was, like... Yeah.
Yes. Okay. I see. I get the vibe. I mean, I actually love this car. this car rules. The boxy little. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it was quite underpowered. I'm not sure it was fun to drive.
Okay.
But yeah.
Very English. It's a very English car.
Yeah. Yeah. It does. Yeah. Well, it's weird with the Rover styling, like, because they've made it into this kind of like Rover has this very like oldie England type styling, and it looks weird on a car like that. Well, actually, I think that the Australians, unusually for a country with so much space, kind of love a small car.
Yeah.
I remember there was
a zip around the city.
Yeah, exactly. There was a video on Twitter a few weeks ago of a guy driving like one of the fucking Tesla Cybertrucks just down like a normal dirt road in the US. And he's like, this car is amazing. It's so great for off-roading. And people were like, that's not off-roading. That's just like a dirt road. Like, you could drive any car down there. And then someone commented and was like, a true Australian would fang a Hyundai Getz down this. Like, yeah, that is very true.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you could do it with the Rover Metro.
Yeah.
Yeah. That would be an option. But yeah, so he doesn't want to do that. He wants to keep a Rover 200 or some other, again, not very glamorous car, but whatever.
Yeah.
So she's like, well, you're going to have to sack everyone. They get to Pear Tree Productions. He then immediately chickens out of sacking everyone, pretends that he has got a second series, and then sets about arbitrarily sacking people for like, imagine, like for Stalinist show trial style. Like, oh, you left this copy cup here, you're fired. And then they're all immediately like, Alan, what are you doing? What is this? And then he goes off to the intercom and sort of confesses from another room that they haven't got a series and they're all fired.
Yeah, and he locks them in because to keep you away from me.
Yeah, exactly. He's very afraid of violence. This is something that comes up a lot. Is he's constantly petrified that someone's going to like hurt him in some way.
Yeah.
So Jill, the secretary, who he kind of fancies. Who it's very funny watching this sort of romance play out because she's kind of playing her age, like early 50s. And obviously Steve Coogan is 32, but playing 45.
Yeah.
And so the two of them together look like quite comical.
Yeah.
But I actually thought she was very well cast.
Yeah, she's great. She plays a somewhat similar character in Spaced.
Oh, okay.
In that, like, she's an older woman who fancies a fellow who lives in the apartment. Yeah, just like
right,
but
right,
that
right.
sort of vibe. But not actually, she's great. I think she's great in this.
Yeah. She's really pulled off the look of like slightly brassy older woman in the office. She's like eyeing up the younger man. Yeah, it's really very, very well observed.
And kind of is just sort of, she's not dumb, but she's sort of like, whatever.
Yeah.
Like life is just sort of like, yeah, all right. I mean, I guess we can do this.
Yeah.
What do I get?
Yeah, the dynamic is that Alan Partridge is putting a lot of thought into this.
Yeah.
And she's not thinking about it at all.
No.
And so, yeah, she's actually out of the building going to get some snacks when he fires everyone. So she comes back and he sort of kind of pretends that she's not fired. And we get this whole thing where he's like, do you like me sex-wise?
Yeah.
Classic Partridge line. And then he's like, well, we should go on a date tomorrow. What do you want to do? I know a cracking owl sanctuary. And then she goes, we could go shopping. And then I think in one of the best smash cuts I've ever seen in a comedy show, you just cut to an owl hooting.
This is why I'm confused about the, I mean, not confused, I mean, it doesn't really matter. I mean, whether or not he's ever had sex before, but it's like, he's at his most sexual in his fantasy about getting the TV show with the commissioner.
Yeah.
When he's trying to get the series renewed, that is when he's at his most sexual because he's dancing. And then when it comes to actual sex, he's like approaching it in a strange way. He brings it up in a way that nobody talks and then cannot do it with the lights on. And it's like,
I like this. We're really getting into the themes.
And so it's like, I guess that's it, right? Is that the thing he's actually attracted to is the TV show.
Yeah. I think, it's like
the continued fame.
He's so obsessed with status.
Yeah.
And that's his, and I think like sex to him is like secondary to status.
Yes.
What's that old quote about it? Everything in life is about sex apart from sex, which is about power. and I think that is somewhat true for Alan Partridge. Like, he's very like, he makes this whole point of like showing off like that he's going to fuck Jill to Lynn. But then actually, he's not that interested in actually fucking Jill. Like, that's kind of like, he will do it, but he's also a bit scared.
Yes.
Like, there's that. Whereas, he's like, he's so desperate for like power and status. He'd rather fuck Tony Hayes.
Yeah.
That's his real dream.
Yeah. Lights off when he's actually, you know, getting physical, but like lights on and we're getting close ups of the crotch when we're, like in his fantasy of what he really wants.
Yeah. Yeah. We do get that great bit where he's like, can I turn the lights off? And she's like, oh, just dim them a bit. And then he like dims them to complete zero. Yeah. Great little throwaway gag. They go to the owl sanctuary. I believe the owl sanctuary is actually a real.
Yeah. I was like, where is this owl sanctuary? Yeah. I have to guess these owls.
Does it quite good.
Yeah.
He also references that he pretends that all of the other members of the team have gone off to Long Stanton Spice Museum, which is real.
Yeah. Great.
It's also funny because like Long Stanton is like, it's little more than a village. It's basic. It's like a very small town.
Yeah.
And it's like up in the fens in like, I feel like it's like very North Cambridgeshire, or maybe it's in like Suffolk or Norfolk. I don't know. But this is like very, having like gone to sixth form and then university in that part of the world, that was always just like Long Stanton, right? It's like a place you'd see on the train.
Yeah. Yeah.
I remember once, so my girlfriend has never seen any of this either, despite having grown up in the UK.
Yeah.
And then one time we were driving somewhere and there was a sign for Long Stanton and I was like, oh, we could go to the Spice Museum. She was like, oh, is it any good? Like, what is that? And I was like, no, it's just, I'm like, how far back do I have to go to make this make sense?
Yeah, it's like, well, all right. To begin with, is this guy?
Yeah. I wonder if it's still open, actually. We could do a field trip.
Do a live episode from the Long Stanton Spice Museum.
The first ever. What's on? It's on. There we go. Yeah, the real Long Stanton Spice Museum. Long Stanton Parish Council. Published 21st of January 2020. Breaking news. The restoration of the old phone box on Magdalen to create Long Stanton Spice Museum has begun. So don't panic if you nip down to the area and see the phone box is gone. It has not been stolen, but simply gone off to be lovingly restored. Watch this space for further news. Well, there's not been any further news since January 2020, so.
Damn. Oh, no. What happened to the guy who was restoring it?
There's a Reddit post here. Today I went on a pilgrimage to Long Stanton Spice Museum.
Great.
Oh, and it's just a phone box?
That's the full museum?
That is unfortunate. Yeah, one of the comments was, unfortunately, there was no model of a slave boat where you press the button and hear the slaves go, they're packed in so tight. That is unfortunate. Although I'm pleased to see this subreddit of quite odd, mostly men, quoting Alan Partridge each other. That's heartwarming to see.
Yeah, of course.
So they go to the owl sanctuary.
Alan makes a comment about all the hawks looking like they're on death row.
Yeah.
And then comments that you couldn't really hang a hawk. You'd have to, the only humane way to kill it would be by firing squad. This is, you know, sometimes online people will say this video has permanently altered the way I speak.
Yes.
And I think this show is that for me.
Yeah.
Like just that kind of cadence of just going like the only humane way to execute a hawk would be by firing squad is so funny to me. And I think that's so inflected all of the comedy that I do.
Yeah.
It's so hard. I think this show is so foundational to like a certain kind of British humor that it's almost like hard to put your finger on like what it is. But the whole just like the pure energy of the guy and what he would say about anything is, yeah, maybe I've been ripping it off my whole career. Maybe that's...
How old were you when you first watched it?
I reckon about maybe like 15.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. It's fundamental. This
yeah,
is real. Core.
Real, yeah, core. Core yeah. Years. Yeah. This has been... it's kind of weird actually to watch it back in the sense that it's like, I think... You really see like the rough hewn edges of it now.
Yeah,
whereas like
yeah.
when I was like 15, I just kind of took it as read. And now I'm like, wow, this is some real, particularly season one. I'm like, this is some low budget stuff.
And you can kind of, I guess you can then, yeah, you can trace it through so much comedy post this. That yeah. is like, you can see it. And it's like, okay, this is where this is like, this is, you can see it echo through up until the current day, continues to.
Yeah, I think so. I think there's probably a few more referenced people, certainly in British comedy, than Steve Coogan. I think he's got a lot to answer for, rightly or wrongly.
Yeah, rightly or wrongly.
I think him and Chris Morris,
yes,
who of course started off on the same TV show, so that kind of makes sense.
Yeah,
have really really laid a lot of groundwork.
Yeah,
and stuff. But you know, sort of Steve Coogan still working a lot. Chris Morris not as much.
Yeah.
Chris Morris, I should say, not because people won't work with Chris Morris, but rather because I think Chris Morris refuses to do so.
He won't work with anybody else.
Yeah. Well, it's just because I think Chris Morris, like, he refuses to be compromised in any way. So, like, he'll have a meeting with a TV studio and then they're like, yeah, we'd love to make your show, but it has to be a bit like this. And he'll just be like, no, I'm not doing that. That sounds shit. And then you just get these interviews with him where he would just like slag off every other like comedy TV show on British TV. And I'm like, yes, Chris. He was like calling some like British satire program court jesters. I was like, man, I'm not sure I'd recover from that if Chris Morris called me a court jester.
It's funny to continue to watch it. That's from his point. It's like, that's perfect. You know, it's just like, I'm like, I don't want to do this show unless I can do it exactly how I want. I also will continue to watch all the shows you make and then criticize them publicly.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. He's a real OG of the British comedy scene. Also, we should say Armando Iannucci is heavily involved in the writing of this show. Mm. Who's also a guy who's like deep tendrils in so many things.
Yes.
Have you ever seen the Armando Iannucci show from like, it's earlier than this. It's like the early to mid 90s.
No.
It's like the weirdest fucking sketch comedy show.
Right.
A lot of it is now on YouTube because I think there's a certain kind of like old BBC show where they're like, whatever, who cares about copyright? Like,
people
just like rip it and put it on YouTube and they don't care. It has all of like, it's crazy because it's peppered with all of these people who went on to be like really famous. And the sketches are incredibly weird in a way that I feel like you couldn't really do on TV now, or they wouldn't let you do it. And it's sort of, you can really see how it informs something like Partridge. Like they've got, so like Alan Ford, the guy who plays Bricktop in Snatch.
Yeah.
They've got this recurring bit where he is like an East End thug who comes around to sort out people's problems. There's one where like someone's washing machine is broken. He just threatens the washing machine until it starts working again.
Right.
And my personal favorite where he's being employed by the Sunday Observer to check if people have actually been reading it. So he comes around, he starts interrogating this woman. And he's like, what does Susanna Clapp have to say about Simon Russell Beale's Hamlet at the National Theatre? And she's like, well, I haven't read it, but I have actually seen the production. She's like, I don't care if you've fucking seen it. I want to know what she says about it. And so that's another, I'll recommend that to the listener. Armando Iannucci show, whack that into YouTube. Have a
what
whale
was the show, Coogan, what they started on? What was the show they started on together?
Day to Day, I think.
Day to Day.
Yeah. I don't know if there was something maybe earlier than that. Hang on, because Day to Day is the first thing that comes up. I think also they did have there was a radio show that they did together earlier than that, which was
called something else, but was pretty close in format to the Day to Day. It was like fake news program and that kind of thing. But yeah, that sort of, I don't know. This is really like we're on my home turf in comedy terms. So yeah, basically, Alan and Jill go on their date to the Owl Sanctuary.
Yep.
They make their way, but he invites her to the hotel for dinner. She accepts. He plays her Gaudete in the car, which is a hymn they used to make us sing at school. Okay. I don't know. Is that, yeah.
I'm like, yeah, I tried to write whatever that was, but I'm like, I can't figure out anything that's being said. And I don't know how to write the reference. Like, I don't know what this reference is.
Yeah.
So it was a hymn they made you sing at school.
Yeah. Latin for rejoice.
Yeah. Right. Gaudete. Okay.
Yeah. And he's just like singing along with it in the car. And he opens with, I think, listen to this, it'll blow your socks off.
I mean, now I get that gag. That's a great gag.
Yeah. It's just like the little details. But also I should say, it's a hymn you sing at school if you went to like a silly school. It's probably not a hymn you would sing at school if you went to like an inner city, like, it's a bit pretend. Your school has to be a bit pretentious.
Yeah.
And then Gaudete will be on the menu.
Yeah.
But it's not like one of the core hymns, which I think is also part of the joke. But yeah, there are so many things I think which are about the character of Alan Partridge, which are like throwaway things, which are sort of, they're never really established or reflected on, such as that he'll just play Gaudete in the car. Yeah. Like that's not like a running thing where he's always listening to classical music or hymns or something. That's just that'd be funny. That's the sort of dumb shit he would do.
Yeah.
But not for any particular reason.
Yeah.
So they get to the hotel, they have dinner. He sort of begrudgingly buys her a rose for charity. And then Lynn comes in and attempts to sort of mess things up. She arrives, she's like trying to encourage Jill to split a taxi with her home. She ostentatiously gets out Alan's fungal foot powder. But sort of none of this really works on Alan because he's just also oblivious.
Yeah.
And we get a line where he's like, I hope you don't think you're going to upstage Jill by wearing that snazzy cardi. And then when she offers to share a taxi home, he says, no, Jill will be sleeping with me this evening. And she goes, oh, I never said that. And he goes, oh, come on. And she's like, yeah. And then we sort of get the denouement of the episode. They go back to the room with their chocolate mousse. And we get the whole dimming of the lights, shebang, all that stuff. And then as they're having sex, he says, do you mind if I talk? Because it helps to keep the wolf from the door. Which is a horrible turn of phrase in that. Do you use that expression in Australia? Keep the wolf from the
door? I've heard the expression. Right, I don't think we use the expression, but I've definitely heard it.
Yeah, I feel like you would, in the UK, you would use it in the context of like tidying off, like either like being hungry or like debts, maybe.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. They're like, we keep the wolf from the door in the sense of like, I'm going to come. It's very strange.
Yeah.
But I guess that is the genius of the writing. That's,
yeah.
And so, yeah, he starts asking her what she thinks about the pedestrianization of Norwich city center. This is going to come back. and that he's dead set against it. And then she's like, I don't mind it really. And then basically she rubs chocolate mousse all over him and he freaks out. And he goes, you know, chocolate mousse from a bowl is nice, but to put it on a person is just demented.
Because he's also worried about the staff, thinking that he's making a statement.
Yeah. They can think it's some kind of dirty protest.
Dirty protest is great.
Yeah. He's like, against the standard of the service, which, you know, well, it's not 5-star, but it's certainly competitive. and then Michael the Geordie comes to the door because he's like, oh, there's been some commotion.
Yeah.
And he sort of tries to engage Alan in conversation and he's like, no, please not now. Now is not the time for this. I'm trying to remember, was there anything else?
He has a run-in with his radio competitor about Valentine's Day.
Oh yeah, it's Valentine's Day. This is probably something we should have set up at the beginning.
Where he's like, you haven't been able to open the door because you don't have the key. I didn't have the key.
Yeah. Like, well, I said that. Yeah. Good stuff. He gave Lynn a sort of a platonic shout out on the radio. And she was like, I really enjoyed my mention on the radio, Alan. He's like, just so you know, that had nothing to do with Valentine's Day. It's like, it pains to be clear. Have you ever been on the receiving end of like a food in bed debacle?
A food in bed debacle? No, I don't think I've
been against it.
Eating in bed?
Or no, like, as in the food in a sex context. Eating in bed, look, we've all had our moments.
Okay, right. No, in a sex context, no. I actually find it disgusting.
Yeah, it's quite horrid, isn't it?
I hate seeing food on someone else's, smeared on the face. You know, like you'll often see a comedy poster. And they'll be like, we've gone funny with a lot of food and slop everywhere. And it's like, actually, this is...
Come and see the slop hour.
Yeah, it's the worst thing I can think of. I think Ed Gamble has a current poster up around on the tube where it's like he's covered in sauce and I cannot handle it.
Covered in sauce?
I don't know why.
What sort of sauce?
Like a mustard and ketchup.
Oh.
Yeah, just kind of sprayed all over him.
Like a hot dog.
Yeah, like he's a hot dog and it's on him.
That is interesting. He's really leaned into this whole food thing.
Yeah, what if food was on me? What if I was food? What if condiments were on me?
yeah. What if that? That'd be off menu. Yeah. Am I right?
Yeah. I find it really upsetting. So even the mousse on him, and I couldn't imagine it on myself or a partner.
Yeah.
But the mousse on him, I'm just like,
there's something upsetting. Just weird because it's bringing an element of something that shouldn't belong, like in the sense of it's like it's taking the sentence eating pussy too literally. Like it's sort of because it's not about the taste. And then when you're bringing something in that is about the taste, then it creates a weird, you're suddenly focusing on the wrong sensory element.
Yes.
And then you're like, I'm not afraid of the taste of a vagina, but it's not necessarily a taste I would seek out outside of a sexual context.
Yeah. I mean,
doing a wine pairing.
You can't be creating if you're putting whatever it is, the mousse, say it's mousse.
Yeah.
And then you've changed the context of mousse forever.
Yeah.
Whenever you eat mousse in a dining setting.
You're just having Vietnam flashbacks. You're at some little bistro in Paris. Not even harrowing,
but at least. But you're creating a...
Oh, I'm thinking harrowing.
but if you've created a sense of arousal at a buffet in the future.
Yeah.
If you're like, oh, for you enjoy, I'm not saying that this is what people are doing.
No.
I'm not saying that these freaks out there are stuck in some sort of.
I mean, if you're someone who regularly uses food in the bedroom, a buffet could be a sort of nightmare scenario. You could be having a kind of Proustian PTSD with all of this different, you're looking over at bread sauce and you're like, oh, that takes me back to one night in Warrington.
It's also, they're always such a sticky foods that are often involved, and it's just you gotta be wiping and washing straight away.
Horrid. Even some lubes and stuff are just horribly sticky.
Yeah,
and I just don't understand why people would buy them. Someone has it, you end up using it, and you're like, it's really horrid.
Yeah.
I feel like I've stuck my hand in PVA glue. I don't know, not sure about that.
yeah
I think food in bed, I feel like once in that sort of sexual phase you have as an older teenager where you feel like you have to try everything that you've seen.
Yeah, you're right.
Represented
the whipped cream.
Yeah. I think we may have had a go with some whipped cream, but quite quickly been this is sex is good and whipped cream is good, but the two need not mix. There was no need to do this again.
It's also you're adding not even in terms of the textures or the flavors, but simply the noise of producing whipped cream. The spray of a whipped cream bottle is not an additional noise that should be in that's got to take you out of the moment.
doing it in someone's ass crack, like a kind of Knickerbocker Rory, putting a little maraschino cherry on top.
Because you can't spoon it out either. You can't dollop.
Well, the trouble with putting whipped cream in an ass crack these days is these paper straws, after a while they're unusable.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm a truther actually about food in bed. I'm like, are there actually adults out there, grown adults who are doing chocolate body paint or whatever the fuck, or whipped cream on the ass or.
I mean, what a question.
It seems weird to me.
Because it does pop up in pornography.
Yeah. Everything pops up in pornography. If there's one thing we've learned.
So it is either...
Take it from two men in their 30s who grew up in the age of the internet. There's everything.
So either it is producers throwing every dart at the board, being like, well, surely there's someone.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But then you can probably see the numbers on, if you had a look at the numbers on a whipped cream.
The whipped cream category. Whipped cream on or
like
Hub.
Strawberries. I'm like, I don't know. What are your top three?
Strawberries and cream, sort of Wimbledon cream.
Yeah. In your whites.
I'm Novak Djokovic.
I mean, how far? Like, it's odds on. There's got to be there.
Yeah.
But there's got to be. That's my question. It's like, what are the numbers on those videos? If those numbers are high, then it's like, well, then it's got to be somebody. Or is it just purely a visual thing that I don't want the smell and the taste and the texture?
I think sometimes with porn, actually going into a niche as a producer of porn is like the most rewarding, because I feel as though, like, obviously there's more of a market for mainstream porn, but the people who want a niche thing are A, very willing to pay for it, and B, there's much less of it out there. So they're going to be a much more dedicated fan base. So I think if you are making the like, oh, it's women stepping into double cream or whatever it is, fucking Pornhub page, you're going to have a lot of subscribers.
Yes.
Probably more than the average generic porn page, because like there's so many of them. There's so many places you could go to and get
yes,
them.
Absolutely.
And as an avid subscriber of the women stepping into double cream Pornhub page, that's what it's called, full name. They've not come up with a branding or a short form.
Yeah. It's not about being it's not about being McDonald's. It's about being like a local restaurant and just serving the people who really love what you do. And that's what they should be doing. You go niche.
Just like a mama used to just like a stepmama used to make. I apologize if I've mentioned this on the pod before to the listeners. The weirdest porno I ever saw what was so weird about it was that it wasn't weird to start with. It was just two couples fucking next to each other.
Yeah.
It was slightly odd in that they weren't really interacting.
Yeah.
They were just both fucking in the vicinity of one another.
So the porn stars are already having sex.
I think there may have been some preamble. I don't know. Right. I'm never watching the preamble. Right, I got
you're skipping straight through to most viewed parts.
I'm getting over this. You know, we've not got time to waste here. There's a limited time where I'm going to have the will to do this. So let's crack on. And, so these two couples are kind of having sex next to each other, whatever. It's like a little bit strange that they're kind of not really acknowledging each other, but fine, whatever. And then one of the couples like finishes and the other couple goes on having sex for like, we're talking like more than 2 or 3 minutes. Like it's a while after. And at a certain point while they're fucking, the camera kind of like pans out and you can see the other couple still naked, just cooking and eating scrambled eggs. Just like and this is clearly like a kitchen diner situation where like there's like a sofa in the living room and then it pans over to the and I was really trying to work out if that was supposed to be part of it or not, or whether that was just genuinely like, well, filming that porn scene's made me a bit hungry.
Yeah.
And if it was sexual, I wasn't sure what I was supposed to get from it. Like, oh yeah, eat those eggs. Fuck yeah.
That's so funny in such a short period of time to be like, ah. Food?
Yeah, it was almost Dada-ist. I mean, to be fair, that is me, but it shouldn't, like, porn shouldn't represent what sex is actually like. Like, porn is supposed to be a kind of like a hyper real, like, because that was kind of a thing 10 years ago. People were like, oh, porn is like an unrealistic portrayal of sex or whatever. And like, obviously, that can be bad. Like, there should be sex education in schools. Like, the only source for children of how sex is should not be porn.
No.
But also, if you're consuming porn, you don't want it to be like what sex is actually like. Like, that would look so bad on screen.
that would not be good.
Yeah,
it's the reason the numbers on some of those amateur videos are low. Like, high because it's just like, well, we don't want this.
Yeah, you're watching and you're like, horrifying. That looks like what I would do. I don't want that at all. Oh, I want some, you know, muscly guy who seems like he knows what he's doing. You know,
Like, I want to watch the elites do this.
Yeah.
This is like, yeah, it's like watching the Olympics. If it was just regular people running, it's just like, I've seen this and I don't like looking at it.
Yeah.
I want to see elite athletes running.
It's creating unrealistic expectations of running.
Yeah.
I think that would be fun though, just to have like also like a dad's race at the Olympics.
I mean, I guess that would also, like, in
like all of their dads.
Yeah,
most of whom are probably talented athletes. It is pretty genetic, I would imagine.
That I mean, I feel like this is a bit that somebody else has done at some point in the past, but surely they should throw one guy in there just so you know how fast everybody else is. Like, these guys are all really fast, and then there is also a dad really giving it his best. Just in fact, be like, oh, that is quick.
People should apply for it.
Yeah.
It should be like the guy who thinks he could compete. Yeah. Like the one, like the someone's uncle. Yeah. He's like, you know what? I've always fancied myself a bit of a, I've run for a few buses.
Yeah.
I reckon I could take on the, I once did a sprinting race actually when I was at university. I was on the cycling team. I wasn't a very good cyclist. I was in like the second team or whatever. Anyway, I used to, we used to do a bit of like middle distance running as like cross training. And so I had running spikes. And our college was always like shit at any kind of like intramural athletics because it was so small. And like we didn't have many people on like the university athletics team or whatever. And so one of the guys in college was like, you fucking have running spikes. Will you come and do the athletics coppers as it was called? And I was like, ugh. And I knew that we had this system where if you did any kind of intercollegiate sports, you got awarded points. Where it meant that then you got higher up like the rooms ballot in the following year. And I was big on scamming the rooms ballot. I always had the best room. So I was like, you know what? One afternoon out of my year at university, I will go and do athletics coppers. And it was a really cold day. And I had like a cold or like a cough or something. And I was supposed to be running like the 3,000 or the 5,000 because I was like, that's what I'll be best at.
Yeah.
And then I got there and I was like, I don't know if I can run 5,000 meters. Like, I feel like that could get very nasty very quickly. And then they were like, well, we need someone to do the 100. And I was like, okay, well, that's not my skill set at all, but fine. Yeah. And then I remember just getting down on the blocks and then going and then just having this sensation of how fast everyone else was running. But it wasn't even like being like, I can't run that fast. It was like, oh, I didn't realize that was how fast you had to run. I ran it in about like 15 or 16 seconds and I was like, oh, I actually could have run it quite a bit faster. I just didn't realize how far, like I was pacing myself in a sprint.
Yeah. Funny to not sprint in a sprint.
Yeah. This guy I knew who was the captain of the athletics team came over and like shook my hand sarcastically as I crossed the line. I was like, yeah, thanks. I know it wasn't a good time. I know that. But I got those points.
Yeah, that's what they need. They need like one person from the wrong sport, the wrong discipline just in the mix.
The time doesn't count.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, I think I might be one of the only people in history to have like bottled a running race. Like you can bottle a hand-eye coordination sport, but I didn't realize that you could actually just like, I got so stressed I forgot I had to run fast.
Literally the only thing.
I know.
The name of it.
I was genuinely kicking myself. I was like, this is so dumb. I was like, can I have another go? Like, I just really feel as though I could do it like a lot better.
I feel like I could sprint this time.
Yeah. Because I've warmed up now.
Yeah.
I've had a little jog. Yeah. Yeah, that was fucked. And I think now this is like in my life in general, I have a great fear of doing something for the first time in a way that matters.
Yes.
Because I'm just like, well, I don't know what the... Like, I have this one, like, I'm a very experienced driver, but if I get into a new car that I've not driven before, I'm like, what the fuck is going on? This is the buttons are in the wrong place. I'm like, I don't...
You know. Let me do it so no one else has seen me do this. Let me do this one time, and I'll be like, all right, great.
Yeah, I got to drive this to Tesco and back.
Yeah.
And then other people can see me do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, terrible. But that was my foray into athletics anyway. Not very successful. That was episode two of Alan Partridge. Not much athletics in there.
No, sadly.
Yeah. Were there any other references that you didn't get?
The other reference is, what's Punch Magazine?
Oh, fuck. Yeah. So I'm trying to remember the context of this, but he says something like about feeling like young and he's like, and I thought, I will do that. I will. And then it's like, and I will buy that copy of Punch Magazine. Yeah. And the other things are like young and cool things or like ish.
Yeah.
In Alan Partridge's imagination. Punch Magazine is a satirical British like political cartoon magazine, but from like the 1800s or maybe even the 1700s. But it ran, it may still be, you may still be able to buy it, but you could certainly buy it well into the 20th century. And it was the source of a lot of those in history textbooks in the UK. They would constantly give you these like, you know, like cartoons and stuff as like historical sources. Like they'd be like World War One era political cartoons. And you'd be like, how is this funny? Like I'm learning about World War One. Like I understand the context, but how is any like they invented being funny in about like 1970. Punch or the London Charivari was a weekly British magazine of humor and satire established in 1841.
by Henry Mayhew and wood engraver Ebenezer Landells.
Jeez Louise.
Historic Gizmos in action in the 1840s and 1850s helped coin the term cartoon in the modern sense. Okay, so it closed in 1992, was revived in 1996, and closed again in 2002. There you go. So it was in circulation at the time.
Recently returned to circulation.
Yeah. Its peak circulation was in the 1940s. There you go.
I mean, the war.
But yeah, like you would just...
You want to laugh.
Yeah, you would see... Exactly. You would see these fucking cartoons in it and you'd just be like, what is the joke here? It'd be like, you know, like Kaiser Wilhelm like biting into a globe or whatever.
Yeah.
And you'd be like, it's too hard. And I'm like, what?
Yeah,
I get it. He wants Africa, but like, what? Where's the joke?
Yeah. All right, great.
Yeah.
And then the only other big one was Bravo 2-0 by Andy McNab.
Oh, fuck yeah. Was that not made it over to Australia?
I mean, it may have, but so, I did not know what that was.
So Andy McNab is a guy who used to be in the SAS.
Yeah.
And now he writes like fictional books about a guy who used to be in the SAS who does like wet work for like the intelligence services and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But the book that made him famous was this book, Bravo 2-0, which is a true story. And this is the sort of thing where it's like, it's not a bad book. It's just, it's the kind of book that the type of guy like Alan Partridge would love.
Yes.
And okay. it was him and like eight guys, I think, were on an SAS patrol that went deep behind enemy lines during the first Gulf War. And all of them got captured or killed apart from him. And he had to walk like 1,000 miles across the desert while avoiding like Iraqi troops, and it's a book about that.
Yeah.
And the patrol was called Bravo 2-0, which is why the book is called that.
Yeah.
But it's like a real, like, that is exactly the kind of book Alan Partridge would love.
Yeah. Right.
So I can read you like a book, not a very good book, not like Bravo 2-0 by Andy McNab, which actually improves with every read.
Great.
Perfect stuff.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, there we are. Well, I hope that was helpful to the listener.
Yeah.
This is like Cliff's Notes.
Yeah.
For Alan Partridge.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm doing my best to, furnish all the refs, do all that stuff. If you aren't laughing, you are learning.
You are, absolutely.
And if you're listening to this, thank you very much for being a Patreon subscriber. You're the best. You keep this pod going. And we're going to be back next week on the free feed. There's still bonus content coming out from the Milo and Phoebe era. Well, I guess that implies that it's like a thing in the past, like she's dead, RIP. No, Phoebe will be returning. She's very much alive and in rude health. But yeah, we pre-recorded a bunch of bonus content. So that's going to be drip feeding out as well during this interstitial period. Also, you should check out Pete's podcast, Ooh Spooky.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Check it out.
That has a Patreon too. If you're a Patreon type of guy.
Yeah, if you love a Patreon, boy, do we have one.
Oh boy, do we. All right, guys. See you very soon.
Bye-bye. Sweet.